Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show, the Friday live edition. Welcome to everyone who is watching us live on YouTube, and hello to everyone who is watching us after the fact on the audio only, or listening to us rather, on the audio only podcasts. Today I'm joined by regular show favorite, Terence Corrigan. Terence, welcome.
Well, that's sweet, Nicholas. How are you?
And for the first time, we are joined today by Ofense Donald Davey. Ofense, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nick. I'm excited to be here. I've been watching the show for years, and it's nice to be on this side of the platform.
Yes, no, very, very happy to have you on board with us today. So, with that in mind, and as we are basking in the warmth of spring that is growing upon us, let us get into the news of today. We're going to start off by talking a little bit about comments that the deputy president has been making in defense of BEE, which I think, you know, deserves some pushback. We're also going to be talking about the crisis of health, in the Eastern Cape, relating to the South African Human Rights Commission's hearing into the malnutrition crisis in the Eastern Cape. And we're going to be discussing GDP growth numbers, economic growth in the last quarter. So let's start off with what Paul Mashatile was saying. In the National Council provinces, which is the second house of parliament, the much under-examined and appreciated House of Parliament in South Africa. But Deputy President Paul Mashatile was answering questions from MPs, and he was asked questions about the effectiveness of BEE, of broad-based black economic empowerment, as it is called by the government. And Mashatile had this to say when he was asked about the effectiveness of the project. He said, "We are in a country where black people are probably 90% of the population, but 70% of the economy is controlled by others. It can't be allowed. It will never be allowed. We have to come up with policies that change that. And anybody who says we must scrap it means we must go back to apartheid. You basically say leave the economy in the hands of whites. And that's how the country is going to work. It will never be allowed. Black people must be employed by this policy of triple BEE, and we have seen that it does work. There are many companies run by black people that are very successful. Those people are empowered by these progressive policies of our government, and we must continue to do so." It is that he blamed the unemployment rate on the current geopolitical situation. Quote, "Unemployment is not a problem only of South Africa. It is throughout the world. When the global economy is not doing well, it affects us here. We must look at this holistically. I, however, will not agree with anyone who says black people don't need to be empowered. We will never agree to that." Okay, Terence, let me start with you. Obviously we've heard all of these arguments before, right? But I think Mashatile here is making them in their most crudest, blunt form. He's creating this false choice. Oh, well, if we don't have BEE, that means apartheid is back. What is your response to this?
Jeez, Nick, do I have to? It's a Friday afternoon.
Somebody has to.
This is just, you know, tragedy turning into farce. I love that. Thank you, Karl Marx. It's like the one thing I really do remember from Marxism 101. Where does one start? South Africa has been a growth laggard for decades now. The problem with the South African economy is that we are not growing sufficiently to keep up with population growth, let alone to clear those backlogs. If you compare South Africa to any successful developing country, which is where South Africa should be, it clocks in about half a third. And the real indictment is investment. You don't have to compare South Africa to Vietnam. You don't have to compare it to Indonesia. You don't have to compare it to Botswana, for that matter. You can compare it to what the to performance to what the National Development Plan said. Yes, those with long memories will remember the National Development Plan that was going to revolutionize the country. Got everyone very excited, kind of like a new Scarlett Johansson movie at the time.
Isn't it still referenced in government documents? I mean, it's supposed to
only point is 30% GDP investment, 5.4% growth. Well, let's just say not achieved. You know, you put the big red cross next to that. It's interesting you say like its crudest form. Yes, it's complete chop logic. Unfortunately, there's a part of me that just doesn't expect anything more subtle. But it's a very interesting thing about BEE, and I've challenged a few of its proponents on this. When does the government ever defend BEE on specifics? You know, if you have your case studies, you trumpet them. You don't have to talk about intention or about the legacy of apartheid. You say this is all the great stuff it's doing. Well, no, it's not. Yes, there are, you know, I mean, this is also distinctly South African chop logic that I get to deal with from time to time. I remember going on a TV station once, and this the host showed this video of a successful land reform project. Then he turned to me and he said, "Well, you see that, Mr. Corrigan, black people can farm." And I said, "Well, look, it may come as a devastating surprise to you that black people can farm, but it's not a surprise to me. However, I don't think that, you know, and I'm glad you've realized this. However, I don't think that, you know, that speaks very well for the otherwise underwhelming performance of land reform, still less so for the destructive raft of policy suggestions that have been brought in to quote unquote enhance it." So yeah,
well, you know, they should perhaps talk to the Department of Agriculture in Limpopo, who seems to be under the impression that black people should not be owners of land, as we saw in the David Rakhase case, which
yeah.
You know, is so twisted and insane to kind of it's, but that's the kind of logic we always run into with a lot of this stuff. Speaking on the racial aspect of this this legislation, Mashatile did say it's not racial legislation; it's transformative legislation. And this is Mashatile. "I spent more than 40 years of my life fighting apartheid. I'm not going to allow it to come back, not in any form. I am here because." Where I am because I want to empower black people because they were oppressed, and today they don't even control the economy. I don't hate white people. I like them. Many of them are my friends. But we must share this wealth. We want the Africans in particular to run businesses to be funded. It's not racism, it's transformation. That's really what we must do. I'm not going to back off.
Is that the sort of a twist on the some of my best friends are blacks argument?
No, he's almost literally saying that. So if it's a, let's go to you now. It's what's, as you know, as Terrence says, there's so little defense of BEE on its record. When it comes to our high unemployment rate, here's the deputy president defending the policies of the government, and you'd swear as though BEE was a new policy that was yet to be implemented based on how he's talking about it. He's saying, well, the economy is owned by whites or whatever. Now, you know, I think his numbers are junk, but assuming he was correct, isn't that an indictment of BEE that it hasn't transformed the country in the 20 years it's been in place? What's your take on these comments by the deputy president?
Yeah, so the ANC has run out of ideas. That's the first thing that comes to mind. When you're still talking about your struggle credentials to make a point out of your failing policies on why they should stay, I think that's just a... it's a sign of defeat, really. Like you said, unemployment is still high. Inequality is high despite all these policies, these transformation policies that are meant to fix all those social ills. The fact that he has to justify them with also using race, saying I have white friends, etc., etc. It's not a good look for the ANC. And it shows that they are not... they're not implementing the changes they need to turn around. All these policies, all these failures, are the reason why they keep declining electorally. But despite that, they still double down on their policies, and they double down on their justification of their policies. And South Africans are waking up. The apartheid coming back gimmick, no one's falling for that anymore. If you're at home, you don't have water, you don't have food, you don't have a job, your deputy president, who has been in power, whose party has been in power for 31 years, saying, hey, our way or apartheid, no one's going to fall for that. We just want jobs. We just want water. We just want food. We just want electricity. We just want the basics. So no one's fallen for the I fought apartheid line. No one's fallen for that anymore. And there's change, and it's good change. People are now basing their political views based off their circumstances and not based off the social construct that the ANC has to be in power because it liberated us and gave us these not racial laws according to Deputy President, but transformative laws. Silly line, he said. But yeah, people are waking up from that, and that's just not working anymore. The political sophistication of South Africans is increasing, but the sophistication of messaging from the ANC is not decreasing.
Yeah, you know, you consider that this is, I mean, look, I think Majidie is also partly defending BEE so aggressively because he thinks it's going to make him look good inside the ANC and in the ANC's internal leadership election. And you consider that, you know, Mashatile may be the front runner for the leadership of the ANC. And, you know, here's a guy who, even in, you know, there are people in the ANC who can defend BEE better than this. This is pretty bad, like pretty low bar. I'm also, did he say, yeah, he said that he had defended BEE that he had been fighting apartheid for 40 years, but he was born in 1961. So what, he was 40 in 2000? You know, I mean, okay, whatever. He, you know, there was all this sort of sloppiness. He was like, oh, you know, black people must be 90% of the economy. Well, I mean, if you're defining black people as you know, black African, then that's like more like 80%. This is just so kind of sloppy. I mean, Terrence, this is, I think, why when there was that favorability polling done about Paul Mashatile, he got an incredibly low number. I think it was only like 13 or 14% positive approval rating. You know, can he improve his standing in our national politics, do you think?
Look, I think the thing to bear in mind is that it's coming off a very low bar. We shouldn't, you know, we don't expect a great deal. Coherence is nice, but we, you know, as an electorate, we don't seem to require it. You know, not having stolen a bunch of stuff was nice, but as an electorate, we don't always seem to require that either. Look, I think I think there is something in that favorability there that you know, not only do we not have people who inspire confidence, we've got people who don't inspire anything. This is not always good. But someone like Jacob Zuma was wildly popular because he was charismatic and whatever. And I don't think anyone really thought that he was a completely upright guy, if I can put it like that. But you know, he was a lovable rascal. Paul Mashatile, I think he asked a lot of people. It's like, who? And maybe that's the problem with the ANC as a whole. It's just that they've kind of become trapped in a, you know, small sort of gilded circle, known unto one another, but not to the country as a whole. I'll tell you, back in the 1990s, you could go and ask people in the street, you know, who's the minister of X, Y, and Z, and a lot of them could tell you. But you know. I keep on repeating this, you know, that generation, they were very serious people. You can say a lot of them were shysters and, you know, not all, you know, some of them were capable of doing some really, really odd things, but they were serious. You know, we've gone from tragedy to farce, where a lot of this is almost comic, the way that it's playing out. Yeah, look, I remember in the 1990s, the January's 8th statement used to be read with awe and trembling. Does anyone even bother anymore? Certainly, we're not agonizing over word choices or whatever. We just hope that it's kind of semi-coherent. But you know, we were relaxed about that.
Indeed. Professor, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
A lot of people in the ANC, sure, they don't have the charisma like former President Zuma, but they also don't have the intellectual capacity that the ANC once had back when South Africa was growing at a 5% GDP rate. So yeah, there's just a decline within the ANC that's hurting itself. And speaking on the January 8th statement, the only headline that comes out of that time is the Secretary General taking a private boat to Robben Island or something like that. Nothing really intellectual to take out of those January 8th statements or during those moments. Yeah.
This is
town called politics.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. But I think this is also why, you know, I think the page is turning in our politics, even if that turning is happening much slower than it needs to. Is that the defenders of, you know, the policy regime of the last two decades or so just don't have answers. You know, unemployment is caused by the geopolitical situation. The ANC's been saying that since 2008. Guys, the global economy hasn't been bad since 2008. It's gone up and down. Just kind of incredible to watch the just sort of lack of answers there. Okay, let's move on to our next story. We've talked on the show in the past about the incredibly widespread level of malnutrition in South Africa. Many, many South African children right now are growing up in a stunted condition because they are not receiving the proper food and nutrients that they need to grow up healthy and strong. And when you aren't fed well as a very young child, it can cause physical and mental problems that will last for the rest of your life. So it is extremely tragic, and it is the destruction basically of human potential and human lives. The worst hit province is, it seems, the Eastern Cape, which has had very significant numbers when it comes to hunger. And in response to some of these news stories, the South African Human Rights Commission has been holding a hearing into the malnutrition crisis. And there was something that sort of struck me about this one. So the Department of Social Development listed all of the plans that it had to sort of fight malnutrition, said it had food parcels, it was creating food gardens to support new mothers with babies and toddlers, it was creating assistance through Home Affairs to get babies registered in a rapid response plan. The provincial manager for the South African Human Rights Commission in the Eastern Cape, Eileen Carter, said that the commission could see the work being done by the Department of Social Development, but quote, the numbers don't lie. As someone said to me, you cannot eat policies. I think the problem is too big for your province. It's running away from us. We need an outside force by ourselves. There are lots of stop and goes and potholes that delay us. We are meeting under solemn and urgent circumstances, said the South African Human Rights Commission commissioner, Ms. Ntuli, when she opened the meeting, that this was not a symbolic hearing. And there was some discussion in this about, you know, there's all these unemployed people standing around and there's empty fields. Why can't the unemployed just be like growing crops in the fields? Okay, you know, maybe. Food parcels, you know, this is important. People need these things. There's child grants, which are important to prevent some of these families from starving. But we are just playing around the edges of a massive problem, Offense, because we are not dealing with the real issue here, which is poverty. You can only deal with that through economic growth. Do you agree?
I 100% agree. It's economic growth, it's job creation, it's making the environment easier for business, for the private sector, so that those people can hire people who are jobless. There was also a call, I read the article, and there was a call for the situation to be elevated, to be declared a state of disaster, state of emergency. I think state of disaster. So personally, I'm not a fan of national government taking control of powers meant for either local or provincial, but more of the same, which is what's been happening in the past 5-10 years, because I swear the story is on carte blanche once every year. So I feel like more of the same is not helping. And if a state of disaster does need to really be declared, I think it should be considered. I think it is a conversation that needs to be had because something needs to happen. Something needs to budge. We can say economic growth is needed, alleviation of poverty, and so on and so on. But that's not something that happens overnight. Hopefully, a state of disaster could be able to save a life tonight.
Yeah, no, that's the unfortunate reality of the situation we're in. Just to comment on that sort of the sort of suggestions during this hearing that, you know, it was just put unemployed people to work on land, Terrence. This is part of a routinely common problem I see in South African policy discussions, is that people massively underestimate how hard it is to do things and do things well. If you get a bunch of teenagers to try and grow vegetables in a garden without really kind of giving them what's what and having good soil and all that sort of thing, you're not going to feed anyone. you know, these things actually need to be done sort of properly and just kind of saying, well, we must just make unemployed people grow things is like not a solution. What's your thoughts on this, Terrence?
Funnily enough, I had another exchange with on air with a journalist also a couple of years ago. He said, well, surely the easiest way to deal with unemployment is just to give people land so they can go and farm. And my response is, well, do you want to go farm? Look, I have 100% success rate of murdering anything that I put in a pot. So, you know, really, if you're gonna depend on me for your food security, you know, like the 7 plagues of Egypt await us, I promise you. South Africa's historical development, and you know, we're a country obsessed with our history. So maybe we could actually learn something from it. Just saying. One of the realities is that peasantry was destroyed. Small scale agriculture, I think, has a role to play in South Africa. It certainly plays a role elsewhere, but they, you know, a country like South Korea or Japan or whatever came out of a very different sort of milieu. Same for a place like Malawi. There actually isn't a huge, you know, crush of people trying to get their 6 meters or 6 square meters of earth to become subsistence farmers. I think that there is stuff that we can do with some of that subsistence economy, and that means like putting in things like roads and infrastructure and providing inputs, if only as a kind of welfare stopgap. And I'm all for food gardens or whatever. I think that's 100%. But at the end of the day, you want people into wage earning employment so that they can then, right, you know, do what people do in a consumer society. And, you know, go to Pick and Pay at the end of the day and buy your food. It's just what happens in a modern economy. I'll tell you like another secret. Even farmers go and buy their food. You know, they like grow food and they sell it to like a wholesaler or a producer. But then they also go to buy their Emmentaler cheese and, you know, the rice-a-roni and whatever else it is that we ingest.
That's exactly right. Right, we don't have, you know, we're not, this isn't 1880 where you have a mostly rural society of people living on the land. We are, you know, despite the poverty, we are actually a fairly modern economy. We have lots of people in the service industry. The majority of South Africans, the vast majority of South Africans live in cities. I mean, what is our urbanization percentage now? It's like sort of 70%, 60% somewhere, high 60s, low 70s, somewhere around there, I think. We, you know, this is a society that is moved beyond that sort of state of conditions. In fact, there's very few countries in the world that live in that position. You have to go like into some of the poorest places in Africa to find societies that are still living with that sort of rural situation. And there, you know, land reform is much more important because you need people to have a stake in the land that they're growing on. And, you know, people are still depending on subsistence. That's not South Africa. We need to get people jobs. We need to get people education. We need to get them, you know, to be able to develop their own wealth and property and assets.
Yeah. And if we don't do that,
we're just mucking about.
Just as far as the Eastern Cape goes, how about we throw a really like bizarre suggestion in? Actually run the government properly, like don't steal all the money. Look, I know I'm, you know, I'm indulging crazy talk on the show, particularly when I'm on a Friday. That's why Nicholas Jerry doesn't like me on a Friday. But as far as rice-a-roni, it apparently it was like an American kind of instant food that you got in the 1980s, apparently a cross between macaroni, cheese, and rice. Now, yeah, it sounds pretty disgusting. Never had it myself, but you know, if that is your game, I mean, I'm all for it.
Offense.
Yeah, but I just also want to add a big issue is political will. Genuinely, it's just political will. This problem has been going on for long, and it's not like there aren't any funds. Most of the time, the Eastern Cape government has to send money back to Treasury because it couldn't allocate this money for food programs. It couldn't channel it to the correct tenders, per se. So the money is there. The political will just isn't. And yeah, if you can just get the basic rights, stop the corruption, don't steal the money, have a clean tender process, get the right people to distribute the food. It's a problem that can be solved. It's not rocket science. It's easier said than done, but it's not rocket science.
Yeah, I know 100%. We do have all of these programs and government assistance things, but we often don't get the bang for the buck that we're supposed to get, right? It's just like our education system where we spend, you know, what is it, a fifth of the budget or something on education, and yet we have these very poor outcomes. Spending the money that we do already have allocated well would go a long way to making these problems less tragic.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Last topic, very briefly. Because we're almost up to half an hour already. We had some GDP data for the second quarter, and it was a little bit better than expected. There were various banks and analysts saying that they thought it would be 0.6% real GDP growth, which is, shall we say, not really shooting the lights out, considering we need to be hitting 5 or 6% in order to actually start turning the country around. But anyway, better than the economy just straight up shrinking. And the final number came in at 0.8%, which was better than expected. Now, the main driver of this appears to have been consumer spending, but one of the other top performers was mining. So in the first 3 months of this year, GDP's, the South African mining industry contracted by 4.1%, which is very bad, although it rebounded by 3.7% quarter on quarter. In the 3 months to the end of June. Now, that means that we haven't made up the difference, but one of the reasons it seems that mining has had a good quarter is because of the really high platinum and gold prices at the moment, which have allowed the mining companies to sell more than usual. Terence, you know, you mentioned you saw before the show a statement by Kasatu welcoming the great GDP growth numbers or whatever it was. This is sort of, you know, this is like just not quite good enough to achieve some of the things we're talking about.
No, it's horrible.
The main thing that's decreasing here is fixed capital investment.
Yeah, look, durable growth is driven by investment. Now, investment, for those who are unfamiliar, is basically when you actually use wealth to create more wealth. So, you know, you build a road or you build a factory or you put it into your retirement savings, although the way these things go, like quite often you lose on that. But yeah, you know, it's about making things that enable economic activity to to take place. Now, in a country like Vietnam, that's equivalent to about 40% of GDP. They literally are, you know, almost half of what they spend is geared at producing stuff in the future. In South Africa, it's about 14%, 14, 15%. Now, what that means in reality is basically it's covering part of the stuff that's wearing out. So, you know, you're building new stuff, just not enough new stuff. Effectively, you are just kind of replacing some of the stuff that's not usable anymore, and that's effectively what that dynamic explains why I've got to swerve to avoid potholes while driving in suburban roads in the wealthiest city in Africa. That sort of explains why, there's these derelict factories in what used to be industrial areas, or why you can go to glitzy shopping malls and see half the places are sort of boarded up. No, it's to say it's not good enough as it doesn't shoot the lights out, or we welcome this. Yeah, you know, I'm glad that, you know, they only chopped my leg off and not my head. No, this is a disaster. Let's call it what it is.
Vince, final thoughts for today on these GDP numbers.
So my final thought is that there's a reason why the mining sector was the one to save us a bit, and that's because there are so it's not the complete reason why, but they're not affected by the U.S. tariffs. So all our mineral exports going to the U.S., they're still going in without being harmed, without harming us. And the U.S., it imports 90% of platinum, and 50% of that 90% comes from South Africa. South Africa is one of the top platinum producers in the world. So we're in a nice spot in terms of our mineral supply and mineral exports, and it's the one thing that helped us not contract, I guess. Just that one little thing.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And it is something you'd think the government would be able to use in trade negotiations, but clearly this is beyond us. All right, let's call it to a close there. Thank you very much, everyone, for watching today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back with you next week on the Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.